Welcome to Access Advocacy on thepowerofvoices.com. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. The goals of Access Advocacy are to improve the lives of patients and caregivers who are dealing with chronic illness of sickle cell disease. Today, we'll be speaking with many of the presenters and attendees of the recent HD Care Symposium on Huntington's disease. First up is Dr. Neil Hermanowitz. He is a UC Irvine neurologist and specializes in movement disorders, including Parkinson's disease and Huntington's disease. Welcome, Dr. Hermanowitz.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to participate.
So today, we're going to ask you a little bit about your talk, and then what I'd like to follow up with is a discussion about this idea of how we're going to get people in the pipeline once people like you who've dedicated your life to really, really specialized areas retire. So let's talk about your talk first.
Well, my presentation today was on a clinician's point of view about Huntington's disease. And I was talking about the variety of symptoms, including cognitive disorders, sometimes psychiatric symptoms, as well as the more perhaps well-known motor manifestations of Huntington's disease, things like the involuntary movements, chorea. I also had included some slides on is Huntington's disease a more generalized or systemic problem, as we know to be the case in Parkinson's disease, where the gut has been getting increasing attention of late.
The really kind of eye-opening part about that, when you brought up the gut, is the fact that we on the sickle cell end are asking a similar question, because in our disease, everyone speaks about the fact that our blood cells are sickle shape and clotting as they're going through the veins, and we don't look at the whole system as to what the damage does to the whole system and the lack of oxygen everywhere, including in the stomach, how that affects it, and the fact that we end up with so many infections and things like that as a result. So that really was a spark, and not we won't continue that discussion here, but something that I was going to like come and talk to you about later. Mm-hmm. Okay, so from the clinician's point of view, is it difficult for you to communicate with patients? What we're finding in our community is that communication between the patient and the clinician is stilted. Have you experienced that?
In fact, I have, and I also, in my talk, I had a slide about that specifically. It's not unique to Huntington's disease, but it's a striking characteristic that there can be a lack of insight on the patient's part about their symptoms, what is the impact of their diagnosis on themselves, are their cognitive changes, for example, their ability to assess the degree of impairment that they have from cognitive difficulty or the involuntary movements that they have, or the impact of some of their decisions that on their own well-being and safety, and the impact that it has on their family. As a clinician, this can be one of the more challenging things to address in people with Huntington's disease, because if they don't recognize that there's a problem, how can it be treated? Even though their spouse or their family members may say, there's a distinct problem here that we think needs to be addressed, if the patient themselves doesn't recognize it or feel that it's a problem, it's very difficult for me as a physician to make any inroads, to make any positive gains if somebody doesn't feel something needs to be treated. I cited an example of somebody in my practice who had involuntary movements to the point that their chair was banging against the wall, and I could hear them on the other side of the wall. And then when I came into the room to talk with them, I asked them, I said, we have medication that can be helpful in reducing the involuntary movements, and his response was, well, I really don't have any troubling involuntary movements, that despite the fact that I could hear him on the other side of the wall. Similarly, that it comes up in other patient populations. It comes up in Parkinson's disease as well. Difficulty with driving may not be apparent to the patient themselves, but it's apparent to their family members. They're having difficulty maintaining their lane. They have difficulty making safe decisions while they're driving. So this does have an impact on dialogue between patients and physicians. Also, just seeking medical attention in the first place can be delayed because of inability to recognize the problems that are occurring. I don't see people with sickle cell anemia. I wonder if it's the same, if people are not seeking medical attention because of lack of recognition.
Well, with sickle cell, because of the physiological problem of the cells actually having problem getting through the capillaries and the bone marrow, there's quite a bit of pain. Yeah. And so the pain causes an immediate reaction. And it's kind of a double-edged sword because the pain is so severe and to the point where CDC has come out and said that the pain treatment of sickle cell pain in the use with the use of opioids should be on the same level as those with cancer and at end of life. But what happens is it takes it's like the elephant in the room is the pain, right? And so all these other things that are really systematic and are really impact the quality of their lives or doesn't get as much attention as the pain. And we see a lot of what you're describing. We see that actually in our daughter, this thing of behaviors where we will point out something, particularly in the judgment part. And that's what was so interesting to me about what you were saying. We'll say, well, if you're taking your meds, you shouldn't drive. And her reaction is, I drive just fine. Well, the car has dings, you know what I'm saying? Or the people around her are having accidents or driving poorly. And she sees that very clearly, but doesn't see her role in it.
Well, that can be the great challenge, that the patient themselves doesn't recognize the problem, but everybody else does. I recognize the problem. The spouse or the parents or the other family members recognize the problem. This is very common in people with Huntington's disease. People get themselves sometimes into dire straits, trouble with the police, put themselves in danger needlessly, or showing poor judgment in that regard. And or they don't keep appointments. They don't take their medications. They are non-compliant with instructions, or both for their medication use and also just in their daily life. That can lead to serious consequences in some circumstances.
Well, we've been really thinking about this, and this is just like great that we're having this discussion. It wasn't quite the discussion I thought we would have, but that's okay. So I've had, over the last year, a lot of time I've spent in hospitals advocating for patients, and I had an interesting experience with a patient who was not doing well and had lived out of state and was hospitalized here at a major teaching university. And we went through several teams of doctors, the hospitalist, the oncology specialist, the pain specialist. Finally, we got to the palliative care specialist, now the team. And it frightened everybody because they used the term palliative care. But it turned out that this person arrived with a team. So there was a hematologist, there was a therapist, there was a social worker, there was a kidney specialist. I mean, there were all these specialists that worked together to come up with the right treatment and to make sure that patient had everything. And I was kind of like, aha, this seems to work. But what I mean, the normal pattern is that the specialist becomes the, in the patient's mind, their doctor. And then that puts the specialist in the role of having to fight that patient, the family, you know, wear all the hats rather than their hat as the specialist. What would you think of as being the ideal situation for you as a clinician in treating your patients, and what other types of services or docs or whatever do you think would help in improving that care and their adherence to taking their meds and everything to help you do your job better?
Well, you know, I think that's a very important point. I think probably optimally people would have, as you describe, a team of people that can have, bring with them different areas of expertise. For example, I saw a patient recently who clearly needs a psychiatrist in addition to a neurologist. So me doing that job by myself is not going to be adequate. You mentioned palliative care and that people may be put off by that title. Sounds like end of life or something like that. I engage home hospice care for my patients with some frequency. Now, that does have a very distinct meaning to people when they hear about hospice. It sounds as though, well, we're giving up. We're not going to provide care. We're going to give you morphine and send you home to die. But in fact, that's not the case. A lot of my patients, I'm talking mostly about Parkinson's disease, but somebody some people also with Huntington's disease, they find in-home hospice care enormously helpful because they get more pairs of hands and more pairs of eyes looking after them. These people all work together with me. I'm one part of the team in making sure that people get as good a care as can be possible for certain circumstances, keeping people out of the hospital, avoiding problems that could make their life less happy or secure. So I think it's important that when the need arises that we, you know, I have to have a conversation sometimes if people are going into hospice and explain that that doesn't mean that I think that they're going to be dead tomorrow or next week. I don't know when, but I think that this is something that could be a benefit to them.
All right, so let's talk about pipeline, because Huntington is a kind of an opposite lifespan of the disease than sickle cell. Sickle cell, very early on, 90% of the time you see signs that the disease is there and active. We have a protocol for the children, pediatric protocols, which have allowed our adults to live, our children to live into adulthood. Right. And with Huntington's, it seems to mostly not be dormant, but not as prominent and doesn't start to really display itself until the person is actually an adult. So for us, we have a real problem because our children live to be adults and we don't have docs for that. We have a huge void of the treatment pipeline for them. Most of the docs in the 90s and early 2000s were looking clearly at AIDS and cancer for our hematologists. So we're trying to get a model of for treatment for our adults going forward. Now, with HD, they seem to be healthy until there are visible signs. And as you mentioned today, there are very, very few doctors ever even get a patient. Is that correct?
That is correct, but that's in part due to the relative rarity of Huntington's disease. There are estimates of about 40,000 people who have symptoms, manifestations, motor manifestations of Huntington's disease currently in the United States. The number may be larger, but that's a figure that's often cited. Compared to, say, 400,000 with multiple sclerosis, 1 million with Parkinson's disease. So the numbers are simply fewer. So the likelihood that a physician in general practice or in general neurology practice in the community would encounter somebody with Huntington's disease is low. So one would have to, as I do, have an active process or seeking people who have these diagnoses or have some recognition so that they seek out a certain physician. So otherwise, you're just not going to encounter it very often. In terms of becoming familiar with these relatively uncommon diseases, it does require an intent to do so. One has to set out in training, usually early on at the time of fellowship, and say, I'm going to focus on this area within neurology. I'm going to focus on epilepsy. I'm going to focus on movement disorders. And then if one focuses on movement disorders, almost invariably, at many locations, there is some exposure to Huntington's disease through that more advanced training beyond general neurology. So I think in terms of creating a pipeline for future physicians, I think it is going to be the natural draw that people have towards some subspecialty area within neurology. I was interested in movement disorders as a neurology resident, and I chose to go into that. And I happened to train at a place, the University of Michigan, where there was a very big interest in Huntington's disease, and I had an unusually expansive exposure to Huntington's disease during those training years. So in terms of enticing people to go into that, or improving the pipeline of younger physicians to go in that direction, I think that relies largely upon the science, which is interesting, the intrigue of the clinical condition, as well as the promise of new therapies. Neurology has long been regarded as a specialty where people make a diagnosis and I'm sorry, but I have nothing to offer. That has been changing, particularly in areas like stroke, but also in Parkinson's disease. And more recently, there has been a huge interest of several large pharmaceutical companies in Huntington's disease. And I think as therapies are developed and these things become more recognized, I think it'll also be of greater interest to physicians who might be drawn to that area, if there are therapies that can be offered to our patients. We go into medicine because we want to do good things for people. We want to be helpful to people. I think that's the, if you ask doctors in general, that's the draw. That is why people apply to medical school, truly. And when there are opportunities to really make a difference in the trajectory of somebody's life, all the more reason to pursue those areas. If there doesn't seem to be much to do or nothing to offer, then that's less attractive, I think, for people who want to make a difference.
No, I hadn't thought of that, but that absolutely makes sense. I mean, we go, one of the things we are doing as part of our advocacy is we actually go around and we speak with first-year med students about living with sickle cell and what that looks like and how it's affected our families. And I've had several come up to me and say, wow, I never knew that. Because, of course, it's been described so simplistically, right, as a blood disorder. And many people think either it's just a childhood disease or that it's been cured because we've been out of the news for so long. So I can see a little bit of what you're talking about, spark, and I think that those of us advocates, particularly mothers and fathers living with someone that we love with the disease, can kind of see a role for ourselves in going out and reaching out to young people and telling our stories and hopefully getting, we don't need, you know, tons of people. We just need people like you said.
The right good people, but I think that does make an impact. I think when people hear your story or similar stories, and they have role models within either medical school or internship, residency, and so forth, that is a draw. And I believe it or not, people sometimes go into an area of medicine simply because they had a mentor in medical school or internship that they were drawn to. It's a personality type or something that sparked their interest.
This is my last question. So I don't know how you think about this, but we've been doing a lot of work going across country, and I've been working with many rare diseases. And one of the things that we talk about is accessibility to, like, a person like yourself, an expert. And what's come up a couple of times in the past year has been this idea of telemedicine. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Telemedicine is the future. It should be here and now. It should be the present. But it is, I'm absolutely certain, it is the way we will practice medicine, especially for uncommon disorders where the expertise is not on every corner. It is the way to go. I engage in telemedicine with patients right now. I can't bill them for it because Medicare doesn't allow that unless they're residing in an underserved area, which excludes most of California. But I have patients who live here in Orange County, and they're 85 years old, and they have Parkinson's disease, and just going from Fullerton to Irvine is a major undertaking. And they would be so much happier if I could just connect with them by computer, and we could talk or chat over the computer. I can do a neurological examination very similar to what I do in the office for my patients with Parkinson's disease, or with Huntington's disease. If I can see them, and the resolution for most of these cameras and screens is quite good. So I think this is really where we should be there now. I'm sure we will be there in the not so distant future.
Well, I want to thank you, because that has also reaffirmed our other action point, which is, how do we get you guys paid for telemedicine? Because, again, for us, our people are dying. They're dying 10 to 15 years younger in California than any place else in the country. And that's because of lack of trained physicians. And if we're experiencing that here in California, I think about places in other parts of the country where maybe it's not sickle cell, but other things like you've just described, where they don't have proper treatment. And if we could just figure out how to get people like yourself paid for your time and to use the tools, the technology, then we're going to be catching up to where we ought to be. Does that make sense?
We're in complete agreement. The technology's here. It's been here. And it just takes a modification first of Medicare in order for people to be reimbursed. And I think there'd be cost savings on several fronts that would occur with that.
All right. We may be calling on you to testify to that. All right. Thank you very much. This is Access Advocacy, and we are speaking with Dr. Neil Hermanowitz. We'll be back in just a moment with some of the attendees of the second annual HD Care Symposium that took place in Irvine, California, March 25th, 2017. Welcome back. I'm Adrienne Shapiro on Access Advocacy via thepowerofvoices.com. And today we're speaking with many of the presenters and attendees of the recent HD Care Symposium on Huntington's disease. I'm here with some of my friends from Americans for Cures and their friends. First, I'm going to kind of catch up from last year, where we actually did talk with Daniel about ID bracelets, and you guys have made quite a headway with the HD community and your medical ID bracelet. So let's have a catch up.
I want to tell you that we're trying to get the word out about the medical ID bracelets, and it doesn't just pertain to Huntington's disease. It could be any disease, but these medical ID bracelets are great because there are people that sometimes wander off and they're not in the, or wander away from the supervision of family or friends, and then sometimes they get lost or they're pulled over by the police. And with these medical ID bracelets, they would be able to identify if they're suffering from any disease or any condition that might impair their judgment or otherwise.
Now this is a digital ID bracelet. It's not something that's engraved, right? So you can put in as much information or little information, but police, I believe, and fire departments are aware of these bracelets and how to get information?
Yes, they're digital, and they also have a phone number that individuals could call, and a live operator could inform either the police or any first responder about the individual that's wearing them. If you want more information, you're more than welcome to call me. My number is 951-505-1280, and my name is Daniel Medina, and I could give you any information that pertains to the bracelet.
That's great. Coming back from a conference that had many sickle cell warriors in it in Atlanta, I could see where those ID bracelets could really be handy. We had, of course, special travel arrangements where we talked about things like making sure they were hydrated and making sure that the hotel knew that there was a possibility that someone could get ill in the night, and so we are really going to make sure that we take advantage this year of your offer to give us more information and help our community, as well as yours, as well as all of our fellow community members, get this great tool, because it really, as a caregiver, I think I could really kind of breathe if I knew that there was some sort of immediate backup for identity and diagnosis. All right, so Selena has been busy in the last 6 months since we talked to her last. Selena, tell us what's going on with you.
Well, I've been busy. We started a student society for stem cell research chapter, as I had talked about the last time we were together. So we've really just established the chapter. We're trying to get a stem cell faculty member on campus. So hopefully that will give us some more support and another resource for us. I've also recently been accepted to the CIRM Bridges research program, so I'm really excited about that. I'll be starting research full-time in August in a lab in San Diego. And just like how you had previously talked about with sickle cell patients, the importance of pipeline programs and ensuring that future doctors and scientists know how to treat sickle cell patients and families. That's why I'm really excited about the CIRM Bridges program, because it introduces me to these diseases and possible treatments and current research and clinical trials. And I think it's really great that today at the Huntington's Disease Symposium, these patients and families were able to share their stories, and it just continues to inspire the younger generation to continue to learn more about these diseases and realize the implications of them and how these families are affected.
We just asked our clinician, how are we going to ensure that the pipeline is, if not full, at least we have a trickle? And one of the things he did say is that generally what happens is a researcher or potential researcher or doctor gets sparked by someone or something that happens in their lives. And I've noticed you brought a friend with you today to expose to what goes on in this kind of event. So why don't you introduce her, and let's find out if today changed her, and if so, why?
I did. I'm very excited to have Kristen Lane with me today. She helped co-found the Student Society for Stem Cell Research chapter at Cal State San Marcos. So, Kristen, how was your experience here today?
Well, as a soon-to-be graduate, I'm trying to discover what I want to pursue post-college life, and today has just gotten me more excited about exploring the field of and increasing my awareness about diseases and wanting to give back to the community by either going into research or genetic counseling and providing support for the families that are a part of this, you know, global community in diseases. And I'm just excited to learn more.
Really, we did not ask them to say that. All listeners out there, I want you to know. And yes, they are very young and very, very sincere. Yes, and so we have our a young man here, and we're going to ask you, what did you think about today? So introduce yourself and tell us a bit about why you're here and what you got out of today.
My name's Giovanni Medina. I am Daniel's younger brother. We've been part of the HD community for what will be 4 years. Yeah. My grandpa passed away from Huntington's disease a year ago, and my father, we're not sure if he has it, and regardless, it still leaves me at risk you never know. The odds are there. And today, I learned a lot more than what I did last year in the previous symposium, and the stuff that they're doing and the research that they're doing, and it's all very incredible and admiring.
Actually, this is my favorite part of today, I think, is getting to talk to them. And I want all of our listeners to know that this is just a small slice of our community. And we are making real headways. Whether we have a family member that's currently fighting a disease, or whether we could have one in the future, today and days like today change all of that, change the odds. The more we do, the more we know, the more we fight, the better the outlook for the future. So thanks again. And this is Access Advocacy, and we're talking with some of the attendees of the second annual HD Care Symposium that took place in Irvine, California, March 25th, 2017. Access Advocacy board member, Ron Shapiro, caught up with Alan Fernandez, who was the associate director of the Regenerative Medicine Foundation, and now has created a new foundation called I'm Curable, and he's here to tell us more about it.
I've been in the stem cell field, got into it September 2006 was the first time I heard the word stem cell, and got captivated by the possibility of stem cell research and more expanded into regenerative medicine and what these curative technologies might do for those that are afflicted with a host of different diseases. And the deeper I've gotten in the field, the more I see I'm certainly on my path to be the expression that I would like to be for the community, the patient community, most importantly. My focus these days is on building a national coalition of nonprofit organizations that are behind regenerative approaches to address chronic disease and to unite that voice. Right now, the voice is splintered because it's different diseases, different disease focuses, and so on. But I think the collective community could join together in a much more powerful way. So when the voice is needed to advocate for greater funding at the NIH or to advocate for regulatory pathways that might be more supportive to the curative technologies that are coming down the pike, which are different than you know, the traditional pharma drug approach from the past. So I see the importance of uniting the community and then doing what we need to do to advance the next stages of the 21st Century Cures Act that was passed recently in December that has some a great potential for cell therapy, supporting the cell therapy development process. But one critical need besides unity in our own community is bringing awareness to patients and regenerative technologies in a much more expansive way than I've witnessed in the time that I've been in the field. And as a person that's passionate about music, and I've been networking for the last 5 years plus with different musicians, producers, people that produce festivals and so on. And my dream would be to fill a stadium in a couple years to bring mass awareness to the consumers, to citizens that should be all in support of regenerative technologies to alleviate suffering for those who are afflicted and to pave the path, if you will, for the future, their future, when they will become a patient of one sort or another. So there's this just tremendous opportunity. Bring unity, mass communication and awareness to our field in a grounded and responsible way, and to curate our information in a way that helps engage those that really don't know what we're doing in this field and what the impact is to them. Yeah.
So, and one of the ways, I guess, to curate the information is almost like a clearinghouse, I guess. So whether you could benefit from a liver therapy or a Huntington's disease or sickle cell or any number of things, you don't really know where to go to get it. So it seems to me that bringing the awareness and part of your curating would be to get all these little, you know, there's strength in numbers. So, you know, somebody fighting for sickle cell, as Access Advocacy does, you know, people hear us, but not enough. And people with Huntington's disease, they're all pretty much rare diseases when you look at the mass population. And I think your idea of getting everybody together, we have one solid voice, say, look, stem cell research, it's going to help A, B, C, D, all the way to Z and beyond. And I think you're onto something.
Yeah, I think that if you visualize the patients and the concerned families, there's every minute of each day someone suffering from brain trauma in the world. Every 7 seconds, someone's dying of diabetes. And I can't help but imagine the level of concern and desperation and lack of orientation that each of the family members experience searching under the word, words brain trauma and stem cells or regenerative medicine. And right now, I'm not by any means convinced that the landing page is there for people. There's different landing pages, but you really have to know where to go, and then how to assimilate all that information is a whole other area of pain for someone that's trying to, you know, learn about what regenerative technology might be, technologies might be for brain trauma or Huntington's or sickle cell or what have you. So I think there's a lot of existing resources, making them more available, in some ways modifying the information that's out there to make it even more digestible to the general consumer. I think there's a ginormous opportunity related to that. And then I think it's important that if we can curate information in a better way, taking in existing resources, creating a few resources, augmenting a few resources, that I think with all the traffic we could get as a united community of patients and patient organizations connected to some very famous musicians that have millions of followers and so on. I think there's something I sense there that has an enormous amount of power to give us more visibility to vetted, well-curated resources on regenerative medicine. And that should, with all that internet traffic, also keep us as a top search result because we're competing against in some cases, upwards of 600 clinics that are offering stem cell treatments of one sort or another that are not necessarily in the best done in the best interest of the patient, because we know that there's certain aspects of the science that haven't evolved yet. We know we're making progress and so on. So it's important to get more sensible, to get the sensible information that exists out there on certain sites much more widely available. So if someone puts in brain trauma, Huntington's, sickle cell, diabetes, cardiac, or whatever, along the words stem cell or regenerative medicine, that they're quickly finding themselves in a funnel that's taking them to information that they can make grounded decisions with about critical medical needs at the time. Yeah.
Right, because you always hear about people saying, oh, yeah, I have a pain in my shoulder, so I went to the internet, quote, the internet, and it says, oh, I might have to have it amputated because the internet said so. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just like all the snake oil stem cell people out there, how do you make sure? And so I think by having all these groups and all these reputable people that you're associated with together, you can give a confident answer. Or if the answer is not there, you say, you know what, stem cells really won't cure Huntington's disease yet, despite what that guy on the corner who wants to charge you $40,000 for an injection would do. And I think that's so important to have the information, and also tying music. It's almost like taking Live Aid of the 80s and the information age that wasn't there in the 80s and bringing it in such a worldwide, an easily accessible worldwide thing.
That's exactly what we want to do. My organization is called I'm Curable, imcurable.org. That's exactly what we want to do, is to harness the power of music. Another vision that never escapes me is that imagine if included with the patient, collective patient voices and patient organization voices, we had within that the voices of all the researchers doing stem cell and regenerative research, and all the companies, and all imagine if 100% of a research lab or an institution and 100% of the employees of a company, as well as 100% of the patients and the patient organizations and all that belong to the patient organization, imagine what that voice would look like. It would be a force that would have to be taken seriously. And we could use that voice for supporting financing, policy, reimbursement, and just general awareness to the broader society. Pick your disease. Every family member has a disease, two or three or four. At minimum, lend a voice to the disease that afflicted a family member. One next step would be support the disease of the neighbor you never speak to. because you see them getting in their car and dealing with their predicaments daily. So it's getting away from our thinking of ourselves and thinking of those that we don't know. And I think if every human at one time took just one step each day for someone they didn't know, or some gesture, that would transform humanity in a faster way, in a productive way for certainly the regenerative medicine space. Yeah.
The people that were here can speak to the layperson. That's Dr. Thompson, I think, is a master of that. I've heard her speak a few times. And it's like, I understand everything she talks about, and yet she's a scientist, and the people that are telling their stories, I think, motivate the people that are working on these cures, because they're locked in the lab. Yeah. They don't see the faces. And now, they, you know, events like this and the past events that you've done, and I can't wait to see what's coming next from you, because I can see the ideas just spouting out of your head right now, you know, like little balloons.
Yeah, you know? I'm deeply committed to the Huntington's community as well as all the other disease communities, and live with a tremendous amount of passion, and there's plenty of fuel in the tank energetically with my heart. My heart's huge, and I can't take it. So I'm just channeling my desire, my deep personal desire to be of of greater value to humanity, right? Just based on my own walk in life and who I've met and who I can meet or whatever. I think there's something exciting brewing here, and I think everyone's going to benefit. I think everyone's going to benefit. That's the key. And in the development, I think, of what's needed next for the regenerative medicine field is that focus on the patient like never done before in a broader, more unified way, and raise empathy and compassion with those that are not afflicted, and raise people's consciousness, and then provide a more effective, simple engagement mechanism so we can capture more names of people that are interested citizens that want to support our field. Yeah, that's the dream. Yeah, for sure.
Alan Fernandez, I hope the dream comes true. I'm looking forward to the next thing, and we will talk again soon. Thank you so much for joining us on Access Advocacy. We'll be right back.
This is Access Advocacy, and we've been speaking with some of the presenters and attendees of the recent HD Care Symposium on Huntington's disease. We're here now with Francis Saldana, the president of HD Care, and Dr. Sarah Hernandez, who shares a personal story with us today, which is quite moving.
Thank you. So basically, when I was 12 years old, I found out Huntington's runs in my family. I was told that my grandmother died from Huntington's, and not much else. And so slowly it started to become apparent who in my mother's generation would get Huntington's. She had 5 siblings in total, one of which died when they were young. And fortunately for me and my mother, she was not one of the ones that inherited Huntington's. But 2 of her brothers were. And one of her brothers, kind of his whole life, said he felt like he was going to get Huntington's. And so he never had kids. He made that self-sacrifice, thinking that if he had Huntington's, he didn't want to pass it on. But one of my mother's other brothers, who did end up getting Huntington's, he had 3 daughters, Katie, Kelly, and Carrie. And they remained at risk for a long time. And my Uncle John ended up dying before knowing if any of them inherited Huntington's. But my middle cousin, Kelly, she now has a daughter, Ava, and she decided to get tested because she started seeing symptoms of Huntington's. And so it was an incredibly brave decision that she made, and I think it's one that's essential for people to hear about, because without patients that are willing to make that decision, we wouldn't have patients for clinical trials, and we wouldn't have patients to donate tissue so that we can try to develop a treatment for Huntington's. It's a very cyclical story. Like, my mother's generation was affected by it, and now my generation is affected by it, and now Kelly's daughter Ava has a chance of being affected by it. And so it's a very cyclical story.
Well, it has a little bit of a twist in that it did inspire you, right, to do what you're doing now. And it's very powerful that you've chosen genetics as your research area.
Yeah, so when I was 12, it's kind of the blurb about Huntington's in every high school genetics book. It's one paragraph long, and it certainly doesn't encompass the way every family feels. But because it didn't have that much in it, it really inspired me to want a career in HD research. And so I went to college and I majored in biology, I minored in chemistry, and I always knew I wanted a career in HD research. It's a lot of school, so it certainly wasn't a decision I took on lightly. So after I graduated from college, I was working as a chemist for a little while, weighing different graduate school options. I got accepted to the Biology and Biotechnology PhD program at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. It's a mouthful. In 2010, and then I ended up graduating in 2015, after which I accepted a postdoc position here at UC Irvine with Dr. Leslie Thompson. And so it's been a long road, but it's certainly been driven by my past, and I always think it's interesting, especially in HD families, to see how people's careers are kind of shaped by this disease.
We were here last year. And we were hopeful, and this year even more so, in that we now have a clinical trial that's going on, and we have researchers, young researchers like you. So, you know, I tell people all the time that that we're going to be the last mothers. So we're going to be the last mothers that didn't know, really, the nitty-gritty, the details, you know, really what the journey was, because had I known, even though I knew what sickle cell was like and my growing up with my brother, if I knew that you could have a false negative test, I would have made them do three. You know, if I had known all the things that happen to the body, which we know now because we have technology that lets us see actually what's going on in the body. If I had known the destruction of sickle cell rather than just the pain part, which was all I ever knew about, I would have made some different decisions. I think I would have made some different decisions about how my child was treated had I known the full scope of the disease. So I think we're every day learning more and more, which puts everybody in a better position for a better life. So, Frances.
What would I have done differently? So many things. And as you saw, I put like 12 main things that I would have changed if I had known just what Huntington's is. First of all, I would have learned everything there is to know about Huntington's. All I knew was that it was a genetic disease. And I was told by my then fiancé that his chances of getting it were 1 in a million. And we now know that it's not even 1 in 2, it's a coin toss. And as it turned out, he did get Huntington's, and all three of my children inherited the mutant protein. I have lost 2 daughters, and my son is my only remaining child, and he's at the last stages of Huntington's. I would have gotten long-term care insurance so that I could have kept my children at home. They could have just continued to live with the family instead of living in a care home. I would have never purchased a 2-story house. I would have made sure that I had a 1-story house so that my daughter Marie could have stayed longer at home before having to go to a care home. She kept falling, and because sometimes they can't reason, they don't listen when you tell them, don't go downstairs unless I'm with you. I would have made sure I had a good attorney that could have helped me get Social Security benefits for my son Michael. He was disabled, I would say, 10 years before he actually got Social Security benefits. There are so many things I would have done differently. One thing for sure, of course, this was not available for me. When I had my children, I would have gone through IVF because I would never want to bring a child into the world to suffer the way my children have. I would have done everything I could to make sure that my child would not have Huntington's disease. And if I had even known that my husband at the time was going to have it, I probably would have adopted children because I love children. That is the main thing that has changed everything. So right there, with their father gone and all 3 of my children becoming sick with Huntington's, that in a way has wiped out my entire family. I have 2 grandchildren who are now at risk to inherit Huntington's. And it has affected them. They don't talk about it. Personally, I don't want them tested. Why would I want them tested? What if they have it and there's no treatment? I do want them to participate in clinical trials and they don't have to know that they have it if they do. Everybody should participate. Anybody that's at risk should participate. It's a gift to the rest of the families. So by the time I tried to enroll my children in clinical trials, they were too sick. All three of my children got juvenile onset of Huntington's. So those are some of the things I would have done differently.
The only thing that I think I would add to that is that I would have gotten myself some counseling earlier. The weight of being a mother is heavy enough. The weight of having a child that has a genetic disease is even heavier. And then you add upon that a lifetime, however long that is, of suffering. They talked a little bit today about family abandonment, and I've talked about this on the show before, that a chronic illness, a genetic illness, is not a casserole disease in that you can bring over food. I mean, death is even in some ways so much easier, right? Because you can say to the family, Grandpa's dead, and they're like, oh, okay, Grandpa's 106, he had a good life. We're going to cry, we're going to tell some stories, we're going to bring over some casseroles. But eventually we're, you know, in 6 months or so, we can look back with fondness even of that passing and that leaving. But with a chronic illness that takes over your life, they get what I call disease fatigue, and they kind of fall away, like, and you're kind of left with the decision of, do I disconnect from my loved one? Do I get angry with them, my other family members, for not being there? What do I do? And I think for me, the day I decided that I had family, it wasn't blood family, but I had heart family. That's right. And the day I realized that, it was so freeing, that those ties that I'd had and that need from support from those places where I couldn't get any. There was no getting it. We have heart family.
Adrian, you know, we all love you. I just remember when I first met you, we were in San Diego, and I went all by myself, and you were all by yourself, and you were sitting somewhere, you know, and I saw you, and we started talking, and we just bonded right away, because we're both moms with children that we love very much and are going to do everything, fight with everything we have to find a treatment for them. So it's been how many years now? At least 5 years?
Five years.
And here we are, but we're getting closer. I know that they're doing a lot for sickle cell. And then you just heard Dr. Ann Smith, human trials. So, I mean, I just can't wait till they bring it here to the U.S.
I agree. It's going to be really exciting, because everything from Ionis that Ann Smith just talked about was so promising. And the biggest part is that they've shown safety. And so at least we know there will be some mechanism that we can use as a treatment for Huntington's, finally, that's safe for patients.
I think that kind of wraps it up. I think that we're going to be the last generation to face no good treatments. Very soon, they'll be the last generation without a universal cure. Well, we're just about out of time today. But before we go, I wanted to let you know that you can learn more about our organization on our website, accessadvocacy.org, or on the Access Advocacy Facebook page. That's AXISadvocacy.org. Join us next Tuesday on thepowerofvoices.com at noon Pacific, or listen anytime on demand at accessadvocacy.org. You'll find all our programs there. I'm Adrian Shapiro. Thank you for listening. Pushing. I've got to keep on pushing.